assume the whole bill's a veto when in fact there's some very important stuff for the Elks, and there's important stuff for the military personnel, the store owner up in I guess it's a story of there's no address on the military ID. So I would hope that we could maybe let the objectionable part of the since it has its own vehicle anyway run out on its own.
Well, I guess the opponents of that piece can work in the House also. That bill has already passed the House once, and I don't think these objections were there at that point in time. My thought would be let them go talk about it over there again.
I have a great deal of difficulty moving forward given the three letters that we do have, which are don't just state problems. They all say that they're opposed. And so I wouldn't be able to support moving forward. And I also have a similar concern that has been expressed by Senator Corcoran about the issue that Senator Dukes raised, which was contained in Senate Bill 658. Would not want to lose that piece.
Mr. Chair, can I add one other point about that? The circumstances that brought forth the 2456, I think, are very valid in that I think that the owner of the establishment was abused, and I think that there has to be a discussion. There has to be some way to resolve a conflict when OLCC can exercise that kind of authority based on, basically a neighborhood dispute. So, I'm not saying that that the notion behind that particular amendment is bad, but I do think that because the two sides haven't been able to pull any kind of compromise together, that it makes for a very problematic row to hoe. And I mean, we have people go out in the hallway. We have people, do an interim committee. We have people do something to make these things work. I'd submit that OLCC, people either like or don't like OLCC, but this is one particular area of behavior of theirs that, I pretty much defend them. I like, having controlled sales, but I don't like this kind of behavior in OLCC, and would like to see that they reach some resolution with the Restaurant Association. But, absent that right now, I just don't think it's reasonable to harm the bill. And I feel the same way about 134. I mean, I think there's unacceptable stuff in 134, and there's some real important stuff to people in 134. And I'm not talking about third tier. We got the two bills, ironically, today, on the same day, which is why my bill folder is this big.
Here's the small one compared to mine. I will make a motion to move the Dash 8 amendments into the bill. So the chair moves the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 383.
That's what you're linking that for.
Further discussion on the motion. Clerk will call the roll on the motion to move the Dash 8 amendments into Senate Bill 383.
Senator Corcoran.
Well, just for clarification, Mr. Chair, or Mr. Putman, is the language from 2465 in the amendment?
Yes, it is.
It is. Okay, I didn't know that.
2456?
Mm-hmm.
2456. I believe that's section 4. Yes, it is section 4 on page 6 of the Dash 8. And the language of the 2456, or whatever the right number is, has been changed, as you can see from the text of this amendment.
So, we have a vote going on.
Senator Deckard.
No.
Senator Gorgon.
No.
Senator Harper.
Aye.
Senator Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Atkinson?
Aye.
Chair Byer?
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Corcoran and Deckard and Gorthy voted no, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Chair would move Senate Bill 383 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Call the roll, please.
Senator Deckard?
No.
Senator Gorthy?
No.
Senator Harper?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Atkinson?
Aye.
Senator Corcoran?
No.
Chair Byer?
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, Senate Bill 383 moves to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. And I will pay.
It's in the list all night.
Thank you. Okay. Good now. Okay. Open work session on Senate Bill 209.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
Much love, Mr. Putman. Since we've been together last, I've got a dash one amendment that deletes lines 23 through 26 that takes out essentially any thoughts of going to Ways and Means, completely streamlines it down, and would be interested in moving the dash ones when you move into work session.
And we are in work session.
Can I move the dash ones?
Senator Atkinson moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 209. Discussion, objections, so ordered. Senator Atkinson.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 209 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Senator Atkinson moves Senate Bill 209 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Mr. Chair, if it's okay with Senator Atkinson, I'd like to be a no on the floor, but I'll get it off the minutes.
Okay, thank you. Any further discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Atkinson will carry the bill.
Then only this will be.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to carry it.
And we will close the work session on Senate Bill 209. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 463.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's the way I feel about the bill.
Mr. Chairman, we have a resident expert on the committee that knows a whole lot more about this bill than I do. It's a dry cleaning bill. It's an attempt to finance DEQ cleanup programs relating to contaminants from the dry cleaning business. It gives people in that business an opportunity to register their firms, and if they don't basically deliberately violate the law, if they have an accident, the fund, which comes from fees that they pay annually, go towards that cleanup. The fund right now is open-ended. This bill sets it at $1 million. The bill also combines into it provisions of Senate Bill 552, which actually set the fees, and I do not have a fiscal impact statement on that fee structure at this time.
Thank you.
We need to get it, but I just don't have it. Now.
Senator Harper, thanks, sir.
Yeah, that was basically it, committee. Culmination of a year and a half's work for the industry. It's an industry-funded cleanup provision, been in existence since 95. Trying to get the fee issue straightened out in some of the minor technical amendments. It took about a year and a half of herding chickens, and I think we don't have a perfect bill, but I do think we're all comfortable, reasonably comfortable, that we've got something we can work on to get the thing started.
We do. Do you have Mr. Simon set up to testify? Actually, we're just a work session. I don't think we've...
I want to, if you wouldn't mind, I would like some testimony on the record. DEQ is a little nervous about the overall fee aspect of life. I do want this on the record because I have a... We're all on this together. We do need this thing to work, and I think we've massaged this thing to the point where we'd like to get it moving and find out how it works. That's a very important element of trying to define the total box by this listing mechanism where we list all the sites in the state in theory, so we'll know what we're dealing with in a couple of years. So, Paul, if you wouldn't mind.
For the record, my name is Paul Slyman, Department of Environmental Quality's cleanup administrator. I have worked with members of the dry cleaning industry for, I believe it has been a year and a half, trying to figure out the best way and most common sense approach to funding this dry cleaner cleanup program. Everyone has worked in good faith to come up with a funding mechanism. I'll make my remarks very brief, Senator. We agreed in 1995 that we would try to raise $1 million annually in exchange for a release from liability. That's quite a large agreement for the state to enter into with a particular organization, but I think both sides have worked in good faith to fund the program. Unfortunately, we've never reached $1 million in funding, which wouldn't be a problem, except that we do have 10 dry cleaner sites on the waiting list right now that aren't getting cleaned up because the revenue's not available. When sites sit on the waiting list and don't get cleaned up, unfortunately, they sometimes become more difficult to clean up and more costly to clean up. So we're probably not doing the program any favors by having these sites on the waiting list. The problems with 463 that we've not been able to overcome, unfortunately, despite everyone's best efforts, are coming up with a funding mechanism that does, in fact, raise $1 million. And again, $1 million is not a magic number, but just a number that we all collectively could agree to in 1995. Matter of fact, our figures indicate that this new bill would unfortunately raise less than the existing law. The existing law raised something in excess of $800,000 last year. And while I think we could probably all make our estimates, the DEQ estimate is that this bill would raise something on the order of $700,000, maybe as much as $750,000. That in and of itself wouldn't be a tremendous problem. We would still have sites on the waiting list, but more importantly for the DEQ and the state of Oregon is that there's no mechanism, or we have removed the mechanism, to increase fees if we fail to raise the $1 million. I think we would all try and work 2 years from now to fix that. My assertion would be, if we have all the players together now, why can't we continue working on 463 so that there is some sort of fee adjustment mechanism in the bill that would get us closer to $1 million with each successive year should we fail to raise that amount of money? Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask one question? Mr. Slyman, the $1 million, is that, did you say that that's an annual amount?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Well, fire. Excuse me.
Chair move dash 3 to 463, but we need one more body.
I'll vote twice.
Stand down for 2 minutes.
Chair moves a short recess. ordered. Called back after recess.
Yeah. Chair moves Senate Bill 463 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Chair declares conflict of interest. I am a partial owner.
Did we...
One of these things.
Is there any potential that would be too big a fiscal? Is it in the governor's budget for DEQ's budget?
Yes.
It's all self-funded. It's all other funds. Self-funded,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, go with it.
Okay. Any objections? Hearing none. Order. And we probably carry the work session on 463.
Okay. Thank you. Apologize for the delay. We will now get into what the rest of you are here for, which is Senate Bill 134. I just told Patrick we won't get to this one until 4:30.
Oh, okay.
So, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 134.
Fun pack testimony.
Well, he's got to go get his binder. We've gone from a bill file to a binder.
What's this thing here?
Whatever, please. I don't know. Okay, committee members, we are back to 134. And
this must be good.
That must be. I see now in your packets for today there should be a -4 amendment, and which is a new amendment for the committee, and also a -20. So now we're up to -20 amendments on 134. Mr. Putman, would you like to?
Where would you like to start, Chairman? In your packet should be a document that starts out PERS issues for discussion. Just wanted to touch base with the committee, make sure we were in agreement on the bonding item. There are some what appear to me to be purely technical amendments to the -11 by various accountants, lawyers, financiers, and bond merchants. And then it's my understanding that you also wanted to adopt the -17 amendment, which was from EWEB, Eugene Water and Electric Board, to expand the authority of the -11. -11 simply allows bonding for PERS pensions. The -17 would allow pensions for any public entity.
It just eliminates the PERS part of it. I mean, so any pension would qualify
any
with
pension,
a
yes,
PERS
sir.
Pension or not. Okay. Okay.
So if that's agreeable, I will ask counsel to move ahead on that.
Okay. We have, there, Ken, will you come forward a moment? We have been approached by Mr. Armstrong also about an issue on bonding. Do the -11 amendments with the technical changes include your provisions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Armstrong representing Seattle Northwest Securities today. Yes, they do, Mr. Chair. The -11 amendments that you may have in front of you hand engrossed do reflect the changes that we were interested in seeing implemented there.
Thank you. Okay, is there any questions about the bonding issue then? Mr. Starr, is it clear as mud to you too?
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks.
Okay.
You might want to ask Delaney or Boyko to talk to this, but there's evidence that this would add 0.25% to the state fund.
Okay.
And that's going to be upgrade.
Okay. On the pooling, you can see by the list that Mr. Putman handed out what has been tentatively agreed to by the committee. Tom or Jim, or one of you guys want to come up for a moment to get a question to ask you on the pooling piece?
There's also Steve here.
Steve, right?
Steve Delaney.
Oh. Oh, what did I say? Oh, sorry. Sorry, Steve. I'm going to give your names for the record because you'll probably be there for a while.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Voitko, and I'm the director of PERS.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Delaney, manager of government relations at PERS.
Okay. The question is, we agreed to, in concept, the last meeting, to there would be two pools and only two pools, one for K-12, one for everyone else if they chose to join that pool. Could you speak to the potential cost to the state government on that issue if we were to not create a separate third pool for local governments but put local governments into the state pool?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we did ask Milliman and Robertson, our actuary, that question. And, of course, we have to assume how many locals would join the state pool. Assuming they would all join the state pool, because of the slight difference in rates, it would add to the state agency cost about $4 million by our best estimate. And to the community college, $600,000.
What was the last number?
$600,000, Mr. Putnam.
For
the community colleges. And that's because the state's rate is slightly lower than the locals. And this, of course, assumes that although that the entry into the pool is voluntary to join the state pool, we have to assume that the case that all locals would join. So it does assume that everybody joins the state pool, everybody meaning all local entities.
Yes,
go ahead.
Mr. Voitko, if we were to, if the committee were to move ahead with the two-pool idea, in the aggregate between the local governments that join that state pool and what the state is now paying for the pool, the combination, is that larger or smaller than what's being paid now?
I'm sorry, Mr. Putnam, when you say what's being paid, you mean... You mean the state's contribution to PERS?
Is the total going to be between the two entities higher or lower than what it is now? All of local governments are paying X amount, states paying Y amount.
Right.
When you merge them, is the number larger or smaller than X plus one?
The answer is it should be the same. And the reason, Mr. Putnam, is that the amount that's necessary to actuarially fund the plan is determined by the employees and what's owed them. The fact that they've been pooled together or separately really doesn't change the obligation to the members for their retirement. What it does do is that it shares the cost of meeting that obligation among the members of the pool. So the net effect should zero out. And I think we have something that we can give the committee here from Milliman and Robertson that shows that the net effect on the percent of payroll paid is zero at the end. But it would be somewhat higher for the state, somewhat lower for the pooled locals.
When you defined at the end, are you talking 40 years or this year, or is that annually or what?
It should be annually.
Okay. The effect that, and I don't know the House bill, but the one that created some of the controversy with the federal retirees and then the state picking up, you know, or increasing benefits, and what was the effect of that on the local governments? Do you know that number?
I believe, Mr. Chairman, you're talking about HB 3349, and the total cost effect for local employers, I don't know off the top of my head.
1.2 or 1.4, Maria?
I believe that it made a net effect on the plan of about $1.2 billion.
Billion or million?
Billion.
With a B?
With a B.
Okay.
But with respect to its annual cost to only local employers per se, I'm not sure of that number. It's a substantial number.
But because the argument has been made by local governments that they are, in fact, subsidizing the state because the state, collects income tax off that amount now, yet they're paying for that extra cost. So in your opinion, I know this will be, you know, licking a finger and sticking it in the wind right now, but maybe you can get us an answer later. Would these two somewhat offset each other then, that if we then raise the cost to the state by potentially $4 to $4.5 million versus the extra costs local governments have incurred because of that House bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I know that you're well aware of our avoidance of speculation. And so, I will say that we can go find that answer and get the comparison between the costs of HB 3349 to local governments versus, I presume you're comparing it to this $4 million number.
Yeah.
I will speculate that I suspect that that cost was higher than $4 million. I'm relatively confident that it's higher and maybe much higher.
So,
facts will be better than my speculation, Mr. Chairman.
I understand, but I guess as a justification for doing this single pool, that while there may be an increased cost to the state now, it will just help to offset what we have already done to local governments potentially.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's a connection that it's your purview to draw. It doesn't really relate directly to the administration of the pension plan, but I understand the point that you're making.
Okay.
If you ask if he thinks it's a valid question.
We could probably ask that question. Why don't you go ahead and try to answer that? Is it a valid point?
I have heard the same argument, and I must say that the PERS board, I want to make it clear, has not taken up this issue nor opined on this subject, nor has the staff been asked to opine on the subject. To the extent that dollars are fungible, and this is how it's been expressed to me, dollars, the local agencies had to pay for their PERS costs, from their perspective, may in fact be perfectly fungible with dollars that they might have spent on other things. So, from that lens, I can understand why the comparison is made. That's probably a better question to ask of a local government representative than the pension plan administrator.
Okay. What is can you give me a percentage on that? I mean, this $4 million for state, $600,000 for community colleges. Can you give me a percentage of what that is versus their payroll costs?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the state agencies, that would be an increase of about 0.23%.
Say again.
0.23% of payroll. And community colleges would be 0.23% as well. And there would be an offset of a negative 0.23% on local agencies that would net the zero change, because PERS would not receive more money because our set of obligations to members would be unchanged, whether pooled or unpooled. And I might, just for clarity's sake, point out that those estimates of $4 and $6 million our current estimates put against projected 01, 02 payrolls. So, we're looking at what the situation would be if this were in effect today, and all local governments did join the state pool, and we had the 01, 02 payrolls that we've been given as best estimates. I have encouraged the committee in past that this is really Department of Administrative Services issue with respect to the state budget, and we have provided them with the same numbers.
Okay. Any other questions or concerns about the pooling side? Senator Harper, for your information on the, we were discussing on the pooling last time we had decided that two pools would be best, K-12, and then everyone else. There's been a concern voiced by the state government side of it, I guess, that is going to raise the cost to state government and lower the cost for local governments to the tune of about $4.6 million of a shift, is the best way I would say to describe it, of cost from local governments to state governments if we do that. And we've just been discussing that and some of the issues surrounding that. Mm-hmm. You seem perplexed.
No. I just always look that way.
That's probably a very good question. How much of that is going to be general fund dollars?
I'm presuming, I really can't answer that because I don't know how the individual members whose contributions there, you know, would be, whose contributions would fund their obligations, how much of that money would come from activities or FTE in the state that were funded by other funds, by federal funds, or by general fund money. So I'm really not able to answer that question. Daz might be able to answer that question.
I guess the question would be, if you take the long view of this thing, you know, $4 million, it's $4 million, but if you take this in a generational view, which we need to do, you know, the upside better than the downside. I tend to think having the two pools and having the one government pool would...
Well, I would agree with you.
Certainly stabilize the fund.
We talk about trying to stabilize it.
And that's, you know, and the question that I asked, they're going to get an answer to is, how, you know, the 95 that House bill passed?
Yes.
The 95 session, the, whatever the House bill was, dealing with the federal retiree issue.
Yeah, we caused, the state caused some of these problems to start with.
And that cost both the governments an enormous amount of money because, and the state generated by that, and this would help offset some of that potentially. But we're going to hopefully get a better answer than that at some point in the future.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Boyko, when you talk to DAS, would you see if they can give you a preliminary breakdown, give or take a million? How much is general?
General fund versus other funds?
A lot of agencies receive no general funds at all. Lots of DHR get at least 50% federal funds on their administrative costs.
Department of Transportation is gas.
Transportation, employment, neither one of those draw general fund to speak of.
Our own 200 people are other funded completely.
So I would bet a raisin cookie that the number is about half that, not smaller.
Okay. Senator Fisher, are you here to testify on this bill or some other bill? Okay. I think we'll probably be about a half hour before we get to that one. Do you want to wait? Or? Okay. You bet. Okay, anything else on pooling? Okay, let's get down to the third tier, which is the Dash 4 amendment speaks to the third tier. It eliminates the third tier in its entirety, is what the Dash 4 amendments do. They were requested at, they were drafted at my request. Any questions about that?
Well, let's pass those out now, since the Democrats aren't here.
Well, you can put it in now, but
we can get a minority report.
We would have to pass the whole bill now in order to... We could do a whole bunch of conceptual amendments, yeah. I guess. How long do you think it take Judy to get here?
Yes.
Just the word alone, Mr. Chairman. I think she's probably on her way right now.
So that's what the third tier issue is. We then have an issue still remaining with the long-term stability and the different funds, contingency funds, gain loss reserve funds, that whole issue. Thank you. We have discussed that in the Dash 16, wasn't it, originally?
Well, 16 has a lot in it, Mr. Chairman. Basically, I don't think you... Well, I'm jumping ahead. The reserves were dealt with both in the Dash 1 and in the Dash 16. And the people who presented Dash 16 have made a substantial revision to that. I have their proposed revision. I've not studied it, have not had a chance to have counsel look at it. But it's all there. The issue seems to be, to what extent do you want to require PERS to put money into the contingency fund? And how will that money be used? And then, in addition to that, the flow of money into the gain loss reserve.
Has anyone got this chart?
No.
Do we have another one?
Well, we do. Yeah. I decided not to pass it out.
Okay. maybe it didn't help anything up. The concept that we have been thrown around with the contingency would be, currently the loss is up to 7.5% at the discretion of the, well, currently there, that is subject to opinion, whether or not it says up to 7.5% at discretion of the board, or whether or not it should be 7.5%. And anyway, one concept I guess I'd like to throw out is that we would require the first 5%, but, or you know, up to 7.5%, but to make sure the 5% is there, and then to be, and those funds would have to be kept track of in this contingency fund, for and identified as employee portion versus employer portion, so that the employee side of it could be used for employee-related expenses, contingency expenses, and the employer side, so we don't get a problem of mixing. You're using employee money to offset employer costs, which is a concern that has been addressed. Some of the things that need to be addressed probably are unfunded benefit increases. That would be an employer thing, employee thing, or employee-er, I guess. Changes the legislature might make that affect both employee and employee benefits, bankruptcies of employers, legal expenses is related to the employee or employer issues. So that's some of the, I guess that's a concept. Do you have any members have any comments on that one way or another? I guess the concept is to make sure we direct some money into the contingency fund, not leave it at the discretion of the board as to whether or not they think they're going to need it, but say you will put money into it, and here, you know, and get rid of the is it unforeseen language that has created the problem?
Right. In drafting, I kind of issued an edict, which is probably unenforceable, but do we not use the unforeseen word anymore? But we use instead items that were not considered in the projection.
Do you have any comments about that thought? I guess I need to ask someone. I mean, we've got our flow chart here kind of thing, and I guess something that comes to mind by the third page is that we've got the contingency fund, or contingency reserve being funded first. Is there, what order should these funds be funded in? And we're assuming now we're going to have something above 8% again one of these days. And when that happens, the gain loss reserve is going to be down near zero, if not below. So we've got an issue. We've got to get money into the gain loss reserve, and we also want to start building this contingency reserve. You know, as a management tool, should we be refunding the gain loss reserve to amount first, and then deal with the contingency, or should we be funding the contingency fund to this amount and then put the remainder that's available into the gain loss reserve?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, to the extent that the statute has a prescribed use for the gain loss reserve that the board has clearly exercised in the past and continues to exercise, my best response would be to say the gain loss reserve is important to fund. I make that comment based on the board's past actions of funding that particular reserve, I think over the last 10 years to the tune of about $5 billion. And two, that the use of that reserve is directly tied to a statutory requirement, that is the achievement of the 8% guarantee for Tier 1 members. So given that the uses are there, they're manifestly clear, the board has acted in the past to engage that reserve in that purpose. I would have to say that, you know, that's a pretty important reserve.
But current language is that the contingency fund is to be funded in before the gain loss reserve, if there was any such thing as an unforeseen thing, that when the board sees it, it's no longer unforeseen. So.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's not so much the unforeseen language. First of all, under current statute, it does get funded first after the administrative expenses of running the plan. And the board does indeed address that issue each and every year when it divvies up the annual earnings of the fund. Second is that the current statute says that the purpose of that reserve is any deficit of monies available for the payment of retirement allowances. And my best understanding is that's been interpreted as, do we have cash needed to pay our current retiree benefits? And the fund is plenty big enough and plenty mature enough that that need is a need that often occurs early in the maturity of a plan, but not when it has grown to the size that Oregon PERS has. And I think that may be, and I can only speculate because I can't go back and look into the minds and motivations of past boards who made reserve decisions, that may be why the board has not funded this reserve, is that the statute gives one relatively narrow use in the best judgment of the board and relying on our advice from DOJ, and that use has been is no longer current or necessarily relevant. Now, there are differences of opinion about that, I would be sure, but this brings back to the issue of how do you get money into the contingency fund. One of the ways is to create uses for it. The more uses for a particular vehicle, the more reasons to have money in it. And I think that, you know, that's just basic logic. I'm not proposing new uses, but I'm just saying that if the policy objective of the legislature was to create a situation in which there were more reasons to fund the game loss reserve, those reasons would have to be in a statement of its uses and make those uses relevant to today's problems in the administration of the system, as is the game loss reserve, whose, as I said before, its use is clear, crystal clear to anybody that looks at it.
Okay. So,
still 30 months is our goal.
That goal is by rule, right? 30-month goal for gain loss reserve?
The 30-month goal, I believe, is by resolution of the board, not by...
It's whatever, it's 30 months. Is
right. Okay. That's correct, Senator Harper.
And we're down to 10 now.
10.5 months, that's correct, sir.
That was last month, right?
That was at the end of last year.
But now we're probably down to about 6, and the stock market's been tanking ever since the beginning.
I have not done the numbers. We might be lower than that. The market varies day to day. We happen to have a good day today, thanks to Mr. Greenspan.
Mr. Putman.
I may be remembering something that isn't true. The 30-month has been shortened.
No, that Mr. Putman, members of the committee, I think you're referring to the amortization period for unfunded liabilities. That is gradually being shortened. The 30-month period was raised about a year and a half ago and really hasn't changed. Remember that that's a goal. It's the amount of money that we have available that is really what we can use to satisfy whatever needs the statute tells us to apply it to. And in the case of the gain loss reserve, as I said before, the use of those funds has been pretty clear by practice and by statutory interpretation.
It was 18 months prior to that, right?
That's correct.
And it was raised to 30 just a year and a half ago. Okay, well, I mean, and another issue here that we haven't discussed yet, but on the gain loss reserve, we had an amendment that required you to try to get a zero balance or somewhere near, or was it a non-negative balance? I don't remember which amendment that was, but it seems to me like we should strive to have a positive balance in the gain loss reserve at the end of Tier 1, and that would be more direct. It seems to me that would be more direction to the PERS board that we're not striving to avoid a negative. We want you to have a positive. And in my opinion, those are two different things, and that's more directive. Do you agree with that?
It's a policy objective that you communicate very clearly. My understanding in discussions with Mr. Putman is that the language that your council, legislative council, is drafting is to, in essence, bias the board or encourage the board to use its reserve policy to avoid engaging the deficit provisions of the statute such that we would be, if at all possible, to the extent possible, I think is the language, we would try to have a positive balance for the program at the end of its life. That was our understanding of your policy objective. So if that is the case, you've communicated that very clearly.
Does that make sense to everyone? That we've talked about this issue, and now that we have a Tier 1 that is going to end at some point in time, whether it be 30 or 40 or 50 years from now, we know that sooner or later the last employee who was on Tier 1 is no longer going to be with us, and at that point in time, Tier 1 ceases to exist, and we no longer have a need for a gain-loss reserve because we don't have an 8% guarantee anymore. Am I articulating this correctly? And the issue, I think, is that if we direct the board to maintain a positive balance at the end of this Tier 1, they will. It's direction for what to do with that fund when it's end, because they currently have no direction of where that fund will end up. And we certainly don't want it to be in a negative position.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, my board has asked me to reiterate that the reserve policy is one of the things that can affect the outcome that you seek, but the investment environment is the other powerful factor driving that. So my board asked me to make sure that the committee understood that the board could be very aggressive in using its reserve policy in exactly in alignment with the objectives that you lay out in statute, and still not succeed because the environment militated against us. That and the deficits that could emerge in the program won't necessarily show up all of a sudden at the end. It's more that they'll develop in process.
Well, I think
if they were to at all.
Yeah, let's hope they don't. So that's what we're trying to avoid here. I think that the fact that we do have an end in sight for the Tier 1, and then there goes away the need for the gain loss reserve, makes the contingency fund all that more important to start working on now, so we then have another, because once that goes away, we don't really need that. We would still need to have some sort of a contingency in the program, and I think that that's my desire now, is to start a directive here to focus the board that the contingency reserve is an important thing, and we need to start funding that now. And maybe we don't need it for 40 years, but when we do need it, it will be there. And I think that's where I am from the committee.
Charles and I are with you.
Yeah, you guys are standing right behind me. I get that all the time. Well, I think we've pretty much gone. The only other thing we haven't talked about, I think, Ms., would you have a clear direction of where we want you to go? When you go down to, I think Dave's still here. He's taking notes back to like crazy, too. But he knows where I want to go, I guess.
Well, would you like to see language that you want to pick a number, 5%? You go with that, the first 5% of earnings go into the contingency fund, and then probably language to make it absolutely clear that money goes in there, but it stays for the purpose of the entity that generated it. In other words, the employee money is still an employee contingency, and employer earnings are in their proper slot, and so on.
Well, that's.
I think the objective is to avoid having, well, put it in the simplest possible terms, having employee earnings subsidize or otherwise bail out employer costs. That's kind of where we started.
And that, yeah, that's, we have to do that or we lose our federal tax status, right?
The advice that I've gotten from DOJ is that is a potential problem because it confronts, and we have a representative from DOJ here today too, if you'd like to speak to him, Mr. Chairman, that goes against the exclusive benefit provision. I would say that
which if employee money helps employers.
If the assets of the trust fund were used in a manner that was not for the exclusive benefit of the members, and I would like to caution that there are two ways to try to address this issue. One is to try to segment the gain loss reserve into two different parts and then ask the board to try to divine whether this is an employee contingency or, the contingency reserve, or an employer contingency. That term of art, by the way, has not been, that's a new term of art. I can't, if you were to ask me what it means, I'm not sure I could tell you.
Which term is
that? An employee contingency versus an employer contingency. The other way to try to address this issue is to try to create a set of uses that are not about employers or about employees, that are about the fund as a whole. So judgments against the fund, legal expenses of the fund, are concepts that conceivably have nothing to do with employers or employees. They are about the fund. And therefore, I would defer to my colleague from DOJ, but there's a greater opportunity that those would pass legal muster because they're about the fund and not about individual participants in the fund. And with respect to mandatory funding, the only cautionary note I would put on the table for your consideration is that if we don't have legal uses for the money in the contingency fund, and by legal I mean either statutory ones that you give us or ones that you give us that don't get thrown out by the courts, but we have a mandatory funding provision, we could end up with a big pile of money and no way to spend it. So from an administration of the plan point of view, I would caution you that it's the uses that really allow the board, that both provide the justification of the board to put money in the first place and also to get it out. The key is the uses.
Well, and that's where the concern of mine is that somewhere back 25, 30 years ago, a legislature saw the need for a contingency fund and set one up, but the board hasn't used it. And that becomes the problem. And that's why if we don't, in my mind, I guess, put some sort of a mandatory thing on there, then the fund will continue to be not used, and then you're going to find yourself in more lawsuits because the groups are going to say, well, look, you had an opportunity to fund something for contingency, and you didn't do it. So if it seems to me we have to give you some direction as to, number one, fund it, and number two, then, what are you going to use it for? And that's why some of the things that I outlined were, legislative changes. Obviously, that can have huge impacts on the funds because it seems odd that we can increase benefits, but we can never reduce them. And that would seem to me that right there you should have because we know we're going to meet here every other year and maybe more often, and every time that happens, this fund becomes more at risk, it seems like, because the benefits can only go one way.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not here to argue your policy objectives for sure. I guess I would only clarify that, if I could, that I believe the board has not funded the reserve in the past, not because it arbitrarily chose not to exercise the discretionary power that the statute and the legislature has given it, but that the allowable use for the reserve was construed to be very narrow, and therefore to put money in and having no way to get it out didn't seem like a good idea. And as I say, I'm speculating because I can't get into the minds of past boards since 1978, but to the extent you have two options in exercising your judgment about pushing the board to put money into the reserve. One is you can expand the uses and present those expanded uses to the board and say, we have just given you additional reasons to put money into the reserve. You're no longer constrained by the old statute that just gave one use that may not apply to modern times but may have applied in 1946. The other option is to say we're going to give you those uses and we're going to give you mandatory funding requirements. And those mandatory funding requirements could be a percentage of annual earnings. It could be a fixed dollar amount. It could be a target percentage of the fund. But if you give us mandatory funding but no uses that we end up with after the statute passes and is reviewed by the courts, we could end up with mandatory funding. It's a one-way street. Money only goes into the contingency reserve and never can get back out. That's the only cautionary note I put on the table.
This is government. If there's money, they'll be fine to what you Okay. Any ideas for uses? And I think that's the key. We need to come up with a list of what we see are uses, and then anything else, but we can't use the word unforeseen. I mean,
I can't leave Dave and Muir have some thoughts on that.
Do our legal minds back there, have you...
They're confirmed, Mr. Chairman.
Are legal minds, have you come up with a list of potential uses for this contingency reserve? I thought your legal counsel bailed out on you. I guess he just moved seats.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Muir from the Department of Justice. Again, the Department of Justice, and I personally take no position concerning these amendments or the bill itself. The contingency reserve can be used for anything that benefits. In fact, it can be renamed, reused, and reorganized so long as the reserve is used ultimately for the benefit of the beneficiaries. And if the committee is interested in assuring that the contingency reserve achieves its broadest possible use for dealing with contingencies in whatever form they may arise, then we would recommend that you use that you substitute for the existing language in the Act broader language that simply says any contingency which makes it unlikely to that there will be insufficient funds to pay the retirement benefits when due.
Okay. If this is a concern I have, if we give say any contingency such as, and we give a list of 5 or 6 or 4 or 5 or 10 things. At some point in time, then, is the court going to say, well, look, they had some things, so if anything is not on that list, is then not allowed. Is it better, and I understand you can't make an opinion, but in your opinion, legal opinion, is it better to just say any contingency benefiting or any contingency that is relevant to the fund, I think, or to the trust, you said, or is it better to lay out a laundry list and say and give it some uses?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's more than one objective, and let me make my understanding of the objectives express and then answer your question. One of your objectives, I think, is to make sure that the reserve is used, and narrow language limits its use, and so it's better to not use lists. The problem with lists is sometimes we get into disputes about whether the list is restrictive or only illustrative, as you were just pointing out. And sometimes the court will say, well, no, the legislature did not mean anything but those particular reasons that the legislature enumerated. With careful drafting, we can avoid that, but it poses more risk than to say any contingency. But there's another issue here, which I think is implicit in particularly the chair's questions, and that is, will the board actually do something with this contingency reserve? And I think you can put language in the act that directs the board and within time limits to identify areas of contingency and to fund those contingencies as identified. But one thing is objectionable. There are two things that are objectionable that I've heard in the discussion. One is to require funds to go in before an objective is defined, because to do that is, in effect, to divert some part of the income stream to a reserve for which no purpose exists, and then the argument will be you're just tying up pension money which would otherwise go to beneficiaries, and there's no purpose. So there should be a relationship between the funding and the purpose. And when you have fixed amounts like 5% of the income and you don't have the purpose being actuarially determined, like what is the risk, for instance, of an insolvency of an employer, one purpose we've talked about in the past, the argument will be made you're just diverting part of the fund, but there's really no need for it. Let me just stop at that point and say if there are any questions that we can go on. There's some other issues.
Actually, unforeseen circumstances looking better and better.
Well, but what's the thing? Is no longer unforeseen.
With affirmative obligations on the part of the board to identify the risk and within a period of time to state goals and to start funding. So those are all those points are consistent with the trust duty as it currently exists.
Well, I think, Dave, you've listened to this, and I think you understand what my objective is, and I think that, you know, it seems like Bob just made a good point that, you know, if we can identify some potential uses and direct the board to actuarially fund those uses to be, you know, for, you know, keep it broad, I guess is what I'm saying. We want this contingency fund to be funded, and we want there to be, you know, so we don't want to make it so narrow so that there are no uses for it, that we don't want it so broad that it's going to get thrown out in court. And I know that's the billion-dollar question you face every time you attempt to write PERS language, but that's my objective.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. It won't be the first time that I've drafted legislation in PERS where I know, almost am certain it's going to end up in court, no matter what you say. But I I thought that some of the things that Bob Muir was saying here with respect to identifying it and then funding it, I think that that's one of the things that would be most helpful in being able to defend the funding decision for the contingency fund. If you do have a fixed amount going in, and I have to tell you that's what Bob and I were confabbing about back there just before you called him up, then you're going to have the trouble if it's just a fixed amount. You're saying, hey, you're going to put 5% in, but you haven't really had some determination of need made by the actuary that says, well, you really need this much. At that point, then the question will be raised by those who don't like that idea as to, you know, well, why are you putting the money in there? Can you really say that that's needed, or are you just diverting it for the purposes of not putting it into the accounts of the members? And so I kind of like that idea, and I kind of like the idea, too, of what Bob just said about perhaps directing the board to identify those liabilities and those contingencies and leaving some more flexible language with respect to what those contingencies may be. Now, Bob has identified, or the material issue you have, I should say, identify some possible uses that they may very well look at. And so that all makes sense to me. But the real question, I guess, for the committee is do you want to go the route of the guaranteed, you know, the mandatory 5% shift? Because if you go that way, then I think you have to think harder about how you're going to draft it as far as to justify that sort of fixed amount going in every time.
Go ahead.
Dave, what if we were to define some purposes? And then we want money to flow into the fund for those purposes at some kind of a rate, 5%. But then we respond to the idea that, well, if we don't ever have to use them for those contingencies, even though they were stated, that the fund can continue to grow and whatever. Is there some way then to say, you have to let the money flow in for these purposes, but at this rate? But once you get so much money in there, you don't have to do that anymore? Some kind of a cap?
Questions?
You guys can't answer it on this.
Yeah, the guy in the back. Questions. So.
Yeah. Right. Well. Yeah. I think you could have a mechanism to say it goes in at a given rate until you fund it to the extent that's been identified by the board as necessary to fund it, and then at that point, I think you'd have to say it stops, and unless there's some additional liability that accrues as time goes on, so you need to put in more money because of new members, growing membership, or things, you may have to add additional amounts. So you could do that. You could say you could make some direction with respect to funding that initially, but then you'd have to stop at some point once you've got to the figure where the actuary said, really, you don't need more than that. I mean, once you go beyond that, you're into the area of, well, why are you putting money in this reserve?
So that's maybe what we should need to look at is a guaranteed amount up to an actuarially sound amount to fund the contingency
that'll work, I think. I think that would get you past that problem of the guaranteed amount always going in. And you would still need to address the question, does it go to the contingency first or does it go to the gain loss first? I don't know if you had a resolution on that.
I think that's a decision that has to be made on this side of the aisle, quite frankly. I mean, unless there is a legal reason that it has to go to one or the other first.
I can't think of it.
Yeah, I don't think, and frankly, from the effect on employer contributions, it makes little or no difference, frankly.
Mr. Chair, there's no administrative reason why it has to come first or second, except to the extent that there are other requirements in the statute, like the 8% guarantee to Tier 1 members that have to be funded one way or another, regardless of what the that year's funding of the contingency reserve is.
The current language for the contingency fund talks about a deficit of funds, I think. Isn't that the exact words? If you left that language in as one of the purposes of the contingency fund, along with other identified things, and then for some reason there wasn't enough money in the gain loss reserve to guarantee the 8%, wouldn't that automatically trigger a draw on the contingency fund since there are insufficient funds here?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Putman, again, the key to any reserve is the definitions of its uses. And if the uses, you know, said that any actuarial shortfall in the fund anywhere would have a draw on the reserve, then it's conceivable that there could be any of a wide variety of draws, including potentially zeroing out the deficit reserve.
So one of the uses of the contingency reserve could be to offset the gain loss, any deficits in the gain loss reserve.
It could be, except that I would defer to my colleague from DOJ and your legislative counsel. Keep in mind that the statute is very explicit about how a deficit in the deficit account, which is a separate from the contingency reserve, gets zeroed out. And so there's a very explicit mechanism for that, unless the statute made it clear that it was that mechanism as well as funds in the contingency reserve. There would be two parallel treatments. They have to be somehow combined or either kept separate. The deficit reserve part of the statute says that in those years in which there are excess returns above the assumed rate, that deficit has the first call on those excess for Tier 1 portion of the earnings until it is satisfied. And then and only then can you consider granting any of the excess to member and employer accounts.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, your question was, as I understood it, with the existing language which refers to a deficit in the contingency reserve, would that permit the use of the contingency reserve to pay for a deficit in the
existing language?
The existing language, which a deficit in the guarantee reserve, the reserve that guarantees the 8%? No. And the reason is the legislature has already said how the guarantee reserve is to be funded. You draw from it when it's in deficit. You pay back the deficit first out of earnings. Members don't get that money after their 8%. They don't get any of it. It goes into that reserve. It funds it up for 5 years, and after that, there's a call on employers. That's the existing mechanism. And so the general language concerning deficit and the contingency reserve would not address that. And I have to speak about a broader issue that is present throughout portions of the Dash 16 amendments. It is our opinion that the use of the contingency reserve or any reserve in the fund to pay for unfunded liabilities of the employer is a diversion of a trust fund to the benefit of non-trust beneficiaries. You cannot, the statute clearly says, and it's consistent with IRS requirements, that the employers pay the unfunded liability. They pay the liability of the system after the employee contribution. So if liabilities accrue to employers, we cannot take interest from the corpus and use that to pay off those liabilities. The trust is impressed not only on the contributions that are made, but on the interest that accrues to those contributions. And that there is no question in trust law about that. The trust applies both to the corpus, the original contributions, and any earnings on it. So as long as those earnings are used in some way to secure the benefits ultimately, we're good good shape. But if we start using it to relieve employers of their first and final liability to make contributions that are necessary to fund the benefits, we are going to have a challenge. We think we will lose on that issue. So we're here to assist the committee with its policy objectives, but that's one which I think goes over the line, and we will lose on that objective if that becomes part of the law.
Well, we certainly don't want that. I think hopefully you, Dave, we've given you some direction as to how we want this thing to look. The one question we haven't talked to, and I think that I know the answer already, but you know, currently in Tier 1, we've got the 8% guarantee. That's a floor. It has been suggested that we should say everything above 8% goes into the gain loss reserve or the contingency reserve. I believe that is not allowed. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's been the position of the Department of Justice in a written opinion, which we've never recanted. I was involved with it. That the contract only guarantees 8%. If the policy was to give priority to the funding of the reserves as actuarially needed, if that was the legislative policy, we think that's a highly defensible position, even though the actual effect of that will be to reduce distribution of earnings to members, at least in some years. But to say money will go into the reserve irrespective of the need of that reserve, that's the problem. We can't get to that point.
Okay, so that's what we want to do. We got to get that the actuarially sound, you know, reserve, and we have to identify uses for it. We have to guarantee it's going to be funded up to an amount that is justifiable and we can defend, and that's what we want to do. Not much to do with it, Dave.
Hey, Dave, 25 till now.
Yeah, we can stay here till 5 after 5. We've got this bill scheduled for work session on Monday. Is that give you enough time? I would like to be able to move some, you know, take some action on this bill on Monday. Tell me now if that's unrealistic.
Chair Beyer, I would really prefer Wednesday. I got a lot of stuff in today for Monday, and even assuming I get it done on the weekend, our people in the back room trying to get that stuff done, all done for Monday, will be difficult. So Wednesday would be better for me.
I think I misspoke. I think I said we wanted it ready for Wednesday.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Mr. Muir and the Department of Justice have given us at PERS a letter dealing with many of the issues that that DOJ promised to treat with respect to the Dash 16 amendments and related issues. If the committee would like that opinion that was that letter opinion that was given to us, we'd be more than happy to share it with you, and it might assist the Legislative Council in their drafting.
Thank you. Please.
I have the changes proposed by the originators of the Dash 16. Have you seen those?
Yes, Mr. Putman. I've only had an hour to look at them.
So you got 45 minutes of sleep in there. Isn't it?
I would have.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 134. And we've got a couple of House bills left on our agenda. And I was accused of not doing any House bills. See, Representative Patrick, I do House bills.
I have full confidence that the full members of the House, who appear to be a majority of the
state. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 335. This one, 3358, you're here for? Okay. Mr. Putman, you guys want to come up while he presents the bill?
It's a straightforward bill, Mr. Chairman. It adds one representative and one senator to the Oregon Progress Board.
Here they are.
Sets their terms, has them appointed by the governor.
You were worried about a legislative member being authorized to.
I'll just stop there as we have people who know more about it.
We have two volunteers who want to be on the Oregon Progress Board here. So, Representative Patridge and Senator Fisher.
Thank you. I have an appointment with the majority leader at 4:45, so Representative Patridge is being courteous to me here and allowing me to
go ahead.
I'm Senator Bill Fisher from District 23, and I just wanted to add my support to this bill. I was on a as a sponsor of another bill that did part of this, and Representative Patridge saw a problem here because legislators can't serve on the board that have rulemaking authority, so he got this bill drafted, and I didn't get a chance to get signed on to it, but I wanted to come here today and testify in support of it. I think that the Progress Board does good work, but there's been a problem, I think, of really having that work used by the legislature as it should be. This gives the board a direct connection to the legislature in a way to ensure that its recommendations are considered. As it stands now, the Progress Board submits its report and hopes for a response. The relationship between the Progress Board and the legislature is a two-way street. And I know from experience that some members don't always feel like the Progress Board is hearing them. So having members actively participating on the board would provide a two-way street here of communication back and forth. If we're going to have a group like the Progress Board, and I believe the board plays an important role in planning for the future, the legislature should be at the table working in partnership with the board. There's one section of this, Section 1, Subsection 3B, which is a new part in there. I don't know that I would necessarily insist that legislative member get an allowance authorized out of the legislative assembly funds. So I'll leave you to deal with that however you want to, and I'll go ahead and leave this. I didn't get 10 copies here, but I'll just leave a statement here that shows my support and with the committee, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify and be included in your busy schedule.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. Questions? Don't want to keep you waiting. The majority of there waiting.
Echo my colleague's statement here that he ends considering the House members because I was one also.
That's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for hearing House Bill 3358. The reason I brought this bill forward was, again, as Senator Fisher mentioned, the disconnect. I had some substantial problems with the Progress Board during the last legislative session. I spent quite a bit of time during the interim. I attended some fairly high-level conferences, both at the Kennedy School of Government as well as the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Government when we were during the interim in Texas. In looking at the Progress Board and in looking at other boards and similar organizations across the country at where goals are set for a state or where a set of high-level goals are set for a state to achieve, part of what I saw was is the success of those particular things depended upon the fact that legislators be involved and there be some connection between the two. Right now, as someone who's on the budget committee and gets regularly beat up with the benchmarks that the Progress Board sets, as well as use them in a successful manner in terms of talking about accomplishments the legislature has, I think it's important that there be a connection between the legislature and the Progress Board. So that's why we brought this bill forward. The Progress Board, Jeff Trines is here, I believe does some good things and tracks some good things, but I think the legislative involvement is critical. While they had rulemaking authority previously, they never used their rulemaking authority. In taking out that rulemaking authority, I believe that it allows legislators to be able to serve on this board and also influence how the Progress Board sets goals and also bring some reality, especially to the Progress Board, about what the financial limitations are of the state of Oregon. And while it's great to set lofty goals, we still need to set those goals within what we believe are going to be reasonable resources within the near future. And so consequently, that's why I bring you the bill and ask your support for House Bill 3358.
Thank you, Representative. A couple questions I have. One would be, if you eliminate the rulemaking authority of the Progress Board, I'm assuming they use that authority now. Okay.
They don't use the current rulemaking authority, and Jeff Trines is here from the Progress Board.
Okay, that solves that problem. The next one, we have a no fiscal impact yet. If you are paying legislators, there's got to be some.
I think there is a modest fiscal impact in regards to this particular bill, but the public members are entitled to
to receive. The progress board meets on a fairly regular basis. They meet throughout the state. As legislators, we're asked to serve on a lot of committees and other things. I think that this is a critically important committee in ways and means. We spend, I don't know, you could ask Jeff Kreins how many hours he spends there. Our state agencies spend, you know, hundreds of hours a year probably working with particular benchmarks and goal setting for their particular agencies. I don't think it's unreasonable in light of the legislative budgets that we pass to compensate our members regarding the for sitting on the progress board. We're paid to sit on other committees, or at least we receive per diem, but I don't think we ever necessarily make money on those types of things, so I wouldn't necessarily call it pay.
I didn't suggest that, but I'm curious that the, you know, that our staff major summary says there is no fiscal impact, but how often does the board meet?
Jeff Kreins is here to talk about the board.
Yes, Mr. Chair, for the record, Jeff Kreins, the Oregon Progress Board. Board meets every 2 months, six times a year, pretty regularly, hardly ever miss a meeting.
Okay, so figure 12 times a year, and if we figure, or six times a year, that would be 12 meetings for legislators, and if we take a round number of $100 a day for per diem, that's $1,200, so I guess that's fairly minimal.
Sounds like no fiscal impact.
Sounds like no fiscal impact. Okay, any other questions?
Yeah. Are we going to work session?
We're about to.
Okay.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Comments? You want? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Work session on House Bill 3358.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3358 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Harper moves House Bill 3358 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
I think this is a really good idea. We've had talks about the disconnects between the legislative process and the progress board for years now, and I think this is going to help quite a bit.
I think so too. I think we sat through the presentation on the progress board, and yeah, it makes some great findings, yet we never see them after we every other year, and this would be a good thank you, Representative Fatch, for bringing forward. Any objections to the motion? Carries.
And I'd like to carry it.
Senator Harper will carry the bill. I guess we have three members.
Senator Fisher might carry it.
Your name's written down now.
He's snoozed.
Is Representative Shetterly wish to come talk about his bill? You know, is he?
He did, but I haven't seen him.
Are you here for this bill? Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2588.
Mr. Chairman, in federal law, there are entities where one person is both an individual and a business. And to make a long story short, there are circumstances where the employment division has to treat them as though they were two entities. This bill corrects that. Changes it.
Okay. I don't have a sign-up sheet that's over there, so come on forward, whoever's going to talk about it. I'd call you up by name, but I have no idea what that would be, so... Thank you, and appreciate you waiting almost 2 hours as we went through that stimulating discussion on PERS.
Good afternoon. My name is Lou Ann Meyer. I'm a CPA from Dallas, Oregon, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today. I will indeed make it brief, as I have a meter that was plugged for 2 hours, so I'm just about to run out of time. We are here today to make a request that the Oregon Employment Division conform with the federal payroll requirements in regards to disregarded entities. The reason for this, two primary reasons, is that there would be a very small tax savings potentially for an employer, and secondly, it would alleviate what I would call an accounting nightmare for office managers, bookkeepers, whoever, that are attempting to fill out the payroll reports. What I have presented before you today is just a very, very short example. What I'm trying to explain is if we have a limited liability company, in this instance, Pine Tree, It is owned by Smith & Smith, Inc. It's a single-member LLC owned by a corporation. Under federal rules, Pine Tree LLC will not file a tax return at all. It will not have payroll reports to file. It will not pay any payroll taxes. It will not pay FICA tax, Medicare tax. What I'm trying to say here is Pine Tree is totally disregarded under federal rules. However, currently, under the current law, the Employment Division is requiring Pine Tree to file state unemployment reports. What this basically means is if I had someone working for both of those entities, and it could be, let me say Pine Tree manages property and Smith & Smith, Inc. is a real estate agency, and I have a secretary working for both of them. Suppose she earns $22,000 working for Pine Tree and $22,000 working for Smith & Smith, Inc. Under federal rules, you would only look at her total wages of $44,000 and subject that to Social Security, Medicare, federal unemployment, and the maximum for federal employment, the base is $7,000. You'd only look at her $44,000. With the Employment Division, the maximum base for 2001 is $25,000. Those wages of $22,000 would be totally subject in Pine Tree and totally subject in the Smith & Smith, Inc. You would pay taxes on the full $44,000 rather than just $25,000. So we're looking at $19,000 that would not be subject if the Employment Division conformed. That's just one little piece of it, not a big savings, but the last piece is the filing of the reports and trying to explain to these bookkeepers why they're having to do this on the side and keep it separate strictly for the Employment Division. And that's why we're requesting that the Employment Division conform to what the federal law has for federal unemployment, Social Security, et cetera. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
We're in work session.
We're just about to be. Anything else you want to add?
Nope.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Jane Martin with the Employment Department, and Ms. Myers did explain the bill. The impact to the Employment Department Trust Fund is minimal because this is a rare situation, and as she said, it's not huge tax benefits, but it is helpful for the employers, and it has no impact at all on individuals' wage records for their unemployment insurance claims. Everything remains the same for them. It's just easier for the employers and less taxes.
Thank you. House Bill 2588. Chair, I move the bill. Senator Atkinson moves House Bill 2588 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation, I think.
I sure did.
Okay. Any further discussion? Any objections? Ordered. Senator Atkinson will carry it.
I'd be thrilled.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you, committee members. We have apparently we have PERS 134 up on Wednesday of next week instead of Monday, so we'll load Monday up with some other fun stuff.
Excuse me, did you say load? Load?
Load, I think I said.
Will it be, we've met our deadline, haven't we, with Senate bills?
Yes, we have. We are not anticipating taking up any new Senate bills that we haven't already.
We've met our quota for all bills, haven't we?
Awful close.
Boy, that LLC,
we have a bunch of House bills are backed up.
Oh, we got about 30 or 40 House bills in the committee, something like that, 50, I don't know.
You planning a Friday.
Friday is this week? Yes. You'll be here? Well, I'm going to have a bunch of hearings on Friday, the way it sounds.
Yeah, we're in Pendleton. Going to be short, very short committee because Jason and I are going to be.
I knew Jason was gone and Steve was gone and you're gone and so.
Jason and I are working at the town hall.
We will.
I think this Friday is our last scheduled roadshow. So.
We will work some very non-controversial bills on Friday.
You going to get some of your committee back?
If I have a quorum. If we don't, we'll take some public testimony on some bills.
You guys are missing out. That's the construction contractor's board. You got about six of their bills.
Kenneth Tudell, the construction contractor board?
Yeah.
I'll tell you this right now. If Kenneth Tudell, the construction contractor board, doesn't wear his contractor tie, I'm a no vote.
He won't be here to vote.
Well, I thought you'd get around to vote.